And welcome to a special edition of the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. On this edition, we talk to retired four-star general David Petraeus. Petraeus is probably the most famous military guy of his generation. He served as a four-star who ran CENTCOM, helped oversee the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He was the man responsible for the surge in Iraq. He was the CIA director. He famously had a scandal involving an extramarital affair that sort of brought him down as the CIA director. Now he is working as a big consulting firm called KKR. He's working as a USC professor. He's given speeches all over the place. And he was in Southern California teaching at USC and giving speeches, giving a speech at the Syria Institute for Peace, put together this event at the Skirball Cultural Center. They asked me to moderate a discussion with him. So I had about a half hour to talk to him about the world's hotspots. The challenges within interviewing David Petraeus is his answers tend to be really, really long. They're really smart, but they're really long. So you get a lot of insight in them. So this is mostly about Syria because it was in front of a group that was all about Syria. But we also talk about other hotspots as well, and it's fascinating to hear from him. So here is my conversation with General David Petraeus.
Please give a warm round of applause for General David Petraeus. Do we have any other USC people in the house? Anybody? Got a few?
Fight
on to you guys. It's been a tough week for USC, but now we got something to brag about. Here we go. Obviously, Syria is the issue that most people in this room are most interested in. We have those horrific photos up here that showing the atrocities of war. And sort of, I think the big question people here want to know is, where do we go from here? But maybe let's start with the question of what should be the objective for the United States when it comes to Syria going forward?
Well, that is the important question, and we're often quick to sort of jump over that and go right into, oh, we should do this. First, we really have to reflect on what is it that we realistically should be trying to achieve. And actually, you have a phenomenal diplomat, Ambassador Jim Jeffrey, was brought out of retirement by Secretary of State Pompeo. He's in charge of the Syrian issue. He's got some very able assistants there as well. And what he has articulated, what he had articulated prior to the presidential announcement that we were going to draw down our forces, were three objectives. The first is the enduring defeat of the Islamic State. And I emphasize enduring because we have defeated the Islamic State before. We destroyed Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was the forerunner for ISIS. But of course, we then withdrew. The Iraqis took their eye off it. They actually created conditions by highly sectarian activities against the Sunni Arab population in Iraq that actually gave rise to ISIS and allowed them to get back off their feet, exploit the Syrian civil war, and sweep back into Iraq. So again, it has to be a sustained commitment that ensures that ISIS stays down on the ground. And by the way, what we have defeated so far is ISIS the army. This is not ISIS the insurgents or ISIS the terrorist cells. And some of these elements have already, they've fled, they escaped, and they have gone into insurgent mode or terrorist mode. And there's still a residual amount of attacks that you see in Iraq if you follow it closely. In fact, in many of the same areas where we had to fight Al-Qaeda in Iraq in the insurgency days, and the same will be true in Syria. So it's going to take a continued effort in that regard. The second objective that Ambassador Jeffrey announced was a withdrawal of all Iranian-commanded forces. Now, that would mean not just the Revolutionary Guards Corps, Quds Force, and the Iranian elements and advisors that are there, but obviously Lebanese Hezbollah and some of the other Shia militia that they brought to Syria at times when Bashar al-Assad was shaking on the throne. This is frankly a pretty substantial reach, and it may be more than actually proves to be realistically attainable given the means that we're willing to apply. But certainly in that regard, we want to make sure that Iran is not able to establish a ground line of communications that would enable them to travel from Tehran, let's say, through Iraq, through Syria, and then down into southern Lebanon to link up with Lebanese Hezbollah on a ground route. Right now, they certainly can fly stuff in, But that would be very, very dangerous for Syria. It would be dangerous for Lebanon, and obviously it would be dangerous for our ally Israel. And that is achievable, I think. We, I believe, know how to block a particularly critical area where that could take place, but it will require, again, a sustained commitment. And then the final objective that Ambassador Jeffrey announced was had to do with a political settlement that reflects the will of the Syrian people. Now, the truth is that if the Syrian people truly were able to exercise their right to vote, if you will, there's no doubt that Bashar al-Assad would be thrown out of office because, of course, he represents less than 15% of the population, and the Sunni Arabs, who represent at least 65 or more percent, would certainly end up with the president of Syria. I don't see Bashar al-Assad leaving. I don't see an opportunity for the Syrian people to have that kind of vote. So again, what must we do, I think, as a true sort of a moral obligation, is to ensure, at the very least, the security and the well-being of those who have actually carried out the fight to defeat the Islamic State on the front lines and have been doing the bulk of the fighting and dying in that fight, as we have certainly advised, assisted, and enabled with unmanned aerial vehicles, precision strike assets, and a variety of intelligence capabilities. And that means taking care of the Syrian Democratic Forces, the SDF, largely Syrian Kurds in the northern part of that area of northeastern and eastern Syria, and then as you get further down, Sunni Arabs as well. And again, I think we have an obligation to them. I think, in a sense, we have enabled the defeat of the Islamic State by using them as the frontline fighters. And so I think, again, very important that we've seen that there is now a commitment to sustain a force there and not to carry full withdrawal through, as was the stated policy at one particular moment a couple months ago.
Okay, let's all together put our phones on silent, right? Okay. So to sort of dig in on that a little bit, when you were in the government with President Bush and then with President Obama, the stated goal of the government was regime change for Bashar al-Assad.
Well, it was during the Obama administration.
During the Obama administration.
You didn't have the Arab Spring until after Bush left office, of course. During the time of the Bush administration, frankly, I think it's fairly accurate to describe the policy as you did. The focus was Iraq. I mean, President Bush worked very, very hard with the commitment to the surge, and Ambassador Crocker and I had unbelievable support from the president. A weekly video teleconference with him for a full hour. This is unprecedented. Yeah. So he had a direct line to the commander-in-chief. Started at 7:30 in the morning, on a Monday morning in Washington with the entire national security team. But that focus was on really this surge of forces and surge of ideas, because we overhauled the strategy 180 degrees to push back what was an imminent civil war. At the time that we commenced the surge, just to give you an example of how insecure Iraq was, there were 53 dead civilian bodies every 24 hours due to violence in Baghdad alone. And so this was a country that was in fire and it was about to go up in smoke. And that was, I think, somewhat understandably, the focus of the president for his final 2 years. Whereas others were sort of, you know, they'd visit Bashar al-Assad. I think a key senator visited there. I think actually a key member of the House. And so, by the way, I wanted to go visit Bashar al-Assad. He invited me 3 times when I was the commander in Iraq. And I proposed this to the president. And President Bush, and I said, I want to go because I want to tell him that he was essentially allowing Islamist extremists, Al-Qaeda facilitators, to be on his soil to facilitate the flow of suicide bombers and other fighters through Damascus and then into Iraq. And the agreement was essentially, you know, just blow yourself up in Iraq, not in Syria. And about 110 per month were flowing in by our count. We cut that down to well under 10, perhaps as low as 5 during the course of the surge. But I wanted to go tell him that, you know, Mr. President, you're allowing poisonous snakes to have a nest in your backyard as long as they only bite the neighbor's kids. And I guarantee you that sooner or later, they're going to turn around and bite your kids, and eventually they're going to bite you. And by the way, some of these did ultimately coalesce together with the Islamic State and or some of the Al-Qaeda affiliates that actually were able to gain strength when the Syrian civil war commenced. It was only in Obama administration that you
but
had
the president didn't
the
let you do that.
He didn't actually, and so
never
I actually
got to take
in
that
fact
trip.
Yeah, so I, you know, I could see him actually. I think somebody kicked him under the table and he said, well, you know, why don't you sit under a tree until that thought passes, General? And I did. And by the way, interestingly, in the very last month of the administration, Condi Rice and Steve Hadley, the Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, invited me for dinner. I was at Central Command by then. Said, you know, why don't you go visit Bashar al-Assad? And I said, you know, it's just too late. I mean, you can't do this in the last few weeks of an administration. You have to go while the president's still not a lame duck. It was in the next administration, of course, that you had the Arab Spring mm-hmm. in so many different countries, including, of course, in Syria. You had Syrian Sunni Arabs, by and large, but others, probably some Christians as well, rise up as part of that as they saw this transpire in other places. And of course, they wanted to get rid of Bashar al-Assad. By the way, these were peaceful demonstrations until they were violently put down by Bashar al-Assad's forces. And that then precipitated what truly turned into the civil war, which you accurately described. I mean, this has been so horrific. I have termed this a geopolitical Chernobyl, the meltdown of a country. Over half the population displaced, over half of that displaced outside the country and all the way into Western Europe, where it did indeed cause the biggest domestic populist challenges since the end of the Cold War. So it was in that administration that the declared policy of the U.S. was that Bashar al-Assad must go.
And your specific suggestion at that point, famously, was that we should arm these free Syrian rebels, and the president didn't take your advice. If he would have, what do you think, how would Syria look different today?
Well, first of all, I was the CIA director at the time, obviously, and that would have been a covert action if indeed I recommended it. I mean, you can read what you want to into Hillary Clinton's book or Leon Panetta's book, where they do describe apparently what you say.
They take you in the room.
But what I can say is that one of the challenges, of course, and to be fair to a president of the United States, this would be a whole new intervention. We've been doing interventions. He's elected to do nation building at home, not abroad. He's trying to do that. He's trying to end wars, not stop them. And we could never guarantee, there's no guarantee that if you did X that definitely you would end up with a moderate opposition in power in Damascus and Bashar al-Assad would be gone. Having said that, certainly there were opportunities and there was truly a moderate opposition. This is before the Islamic State entered Syria. Keep in mind that was really Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and it wasn't until later that they were able to get off the floor and move into Syria. There were no Al-Qaeda affiliates, as we have had in subsequent years. And there were true leaders and true forces, and certainly there were opportunities. And I will say that it's hard to imagine a situation that could have been worse than the horrific situation that did transpire following that. But obviously, I mean, it's publicly known that we did not take certain actions at that time. Later, there were a variety of actions taken, albeit not on a particularly large scale. And it wasn't until much later, really, and again, to give credit to the Obama administration, that we then experimented, in a sense, with special ops forces in northeastern Syria, but with the objective, of course, of destroying the Islamic State, not of toppling Bashar al-Assad, or even at that time doing something that I did publicly advocate after leaving government, which was, at the very least, to establish safe zones and no-fly zones, which people thought could not be done, but actually, if you reflect on what has happened, that is exactly what we did
right.
do in northeastern Syria and in eastern Syria as we facilitated the defeat of the Islamic State. And it's well known that when aircraft have flown in there, that they did not last, and when ground forces, actually Russian paramilitary, went in there, mercenaries essentially, that they also were destroyed. So that, I think, with hindsight, very much would have been possible, as I felt it would have been at the time. And at the very least, I felt that that was something that we should have done, because it would have dramatically reduced the amount of displacement, dramatically reduce the particularly the refugee flow outside the country. You know, rule number one in dealing with refugees is do anything you can to keep them close to where they lived. Because if you do that, there's a good prospect that ultimately you can get them back there.
Sure.
The farther they go, obviously, the more difficult it is to bring them back, and the greater the burdens on other countries that surround a country, and then again, as it turned out in this case, even further afield.
So we are where we're at. I mean, you know, we can't necessarily go backwards, right? And so now sort of back to sort of the original question is, if regime change is not realistic, where do we go from here?
Well, I think, again, let's come back to the objectives. We absolutely need to ensure the enduring defeat of the Islamic State, of course, not just in Syria, but also in Iraq. I've given five lessons that we should have learned from the wars against the Islamist extremists since 9/11. Very simply, they're, number one, Islamist extremists will exploit ungoverned spaces in the Muslim world. Number two is you have to do something about it because you can't study the problem until it goes away. It doesn't go away. And in the meantime, it spews violence, extremism, instability, and a tsunami of refugees, not just into neighboring countries, but even farther, as we have discussed. Number three is the U.S. generally has to lead, not always. The French have in Mali, the Philippines have, obviously, in the southern Philippines. But we are still going to have to be very heavily involved. And in the big cases, just because of the fact that we have many, many multiples more in certain key capabilities, especially the drones that really matter, the Reaper quality, than all of our allies and partners put together, we are going to have a leadership role. What we do want allies, we do want partners. By the way, we especially want Muslim partners because a lot of the successes that we have had in the fight against Islamist extremists have come together with them. Number four is you have to recognize that you can't counter terrorists like the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda with just counter-terrorist force operations. You can't just drone strike or Delta Force raid your way out of the problem. You have to have a comprehensive campaign. But what we've been able to do, which is hugely significant in more recent years, and give credit to the beginning of this, to the Obama administration, we have learned how to do this by enabling others in ways that we couldn't when we were doing the surge in Iraq or in Afghanistan, because we didn't have the constellation of drones that we now have, and we didn't have some of the other capabilities that we've added to so substantially since then. So we now know that we can carry out this comprehensive effort, which is not just killing or capturing bad guys, not just clearing and holding territory, it's also facilitating political reconciliation, restoration of basic services, restoration of the rule of law, rebuilding damaged infrastructure, schools, hospitals, and getting economies revived as well. And then the last lesson is, and this is what is really apposite here, is that you have to have a sustained commitment because this is a generational struggle. This is not the fight of a decade, much less a few years. And if it's going to go on for a generation or perhaps more, you have to have a sustained commitment. But in a democracy, that has to be sustainable. And I would contend that we have figured out how to do that. 2,000 troops or whatever it is that we had on the ground in Syria to enable the defeat of the Islamic State is very much sustainable. So again, that's the very first objective, and it will require a sustained commitment, certainly with coalition forces, sure, with allies, with partners, and so on, especially from the region. The second, again, how do you prevent Iran from exploiting this and undermining the situation further? Again, you've got to prevent a ground line of communication. You do that by staying in some very key locations where we are currently located, such as Al-Tamf and some others that folks will know is a critical border crossing between Iraq and Syria. And then the third, the political reconciliation of this particular situation is going to be a very, very tough challenge. Ambassador Jeffrey really hasn't been able to pursue that much. The previous UN Special Representative, Stefan de Mistura, one of the world's greatest international diplomats, certainly of his generation, with whom I worked during the surge in Iraq, the surge in Afghanistan, and then observed and kept in touch with while he was doing Syria, he couldn't resolve this. And given, frankly, that Bashar al-Assad is a stronger place now than he has been in more recent years, thanks to the intervention of Russian air power and special ops and further support from the Iranians, that's going to be difficult. And you're going to have to stay at it and, again, take care of those who have been our partners and allies on the ground and just determinedly pursue what is going to be possible to ensure their safety and security and well-being. And then see where it is that you can, with Russia, and this is one of these situations where, yes, Russia is an adversary, yes, it has done horrific things in Ukraine, Georgia, Syria, and elsewhere, but we occasionally have common interests with adversaries, and we should recognize those. They certainly have no desire to see Islamist extremism revive and again, thrust back up into Russia. They have enough of their own problems there. And so again, I don't think they really want to see Iran Lebanonize Syria either, which is what Iran would like to do. They'd like to Lebanonize Syria and Iraq. And by Lebanonization, I mean that you establish a very powerful paramilitary militia, so you have street power when you need it, and that's what Lebanese Hezbollah is in southern Lebanon. And then you gain power in the parliament, so you have political heft as well. And they really, essentially, their coalition in Lebanon has a blocking veto if they choose to use it. They'd love to have the same kind of power in Syria and as well, by the way, in Baghdad.
All right, so we're going to try. I know everybody here is really interested in Syria, and I'm sure there's going to be a few questions about that during the Q&A, but I'm going to try to get a couple other hot topics from the world in as quickly as possible. And the more concise we are, the more we can get to.
You know that I'm a filibuster from
Joe. Yeah, you'd give any senator a run for their money, man.
I have, actually. Yeah. Even Senator Biden, who's known for that capability.
He does have an ability to keep talking, doesn't he?
He can prevail.
Let's talk for a moment about the news of the day. The biggest story of the day was this tweet from President Trump on Israel. This is what he said. After 52 years, it is time for the United States to fully recognize Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights, which is of critical strategic and security importance to the state of Israel and regional stability. What's your response to that? Good move?
Well, my response is that it's going to be very interesting to see what happens in Congress with this, and perhaps even more interesting to see what happens in the Arab world. I am a very strong supporter of our ally Israel, the only truly democratic state out there. I'll give Tunisia credit for that as well, one with whom we share values across the board and so forth and so on. But in this case, we're going to have to see if the Arab world's response is one that then makes it more difficult to achieve progress on the initiative that U.S. Policymakers from the White House, Jared Kushner and others, have just gone around the Arab world and tried to encourage and to foster, and that is some kind of resolution of the situation between Israel and the Palestinians. And so that's going to be a very interesting development to follow, and then also to see how Congress reacts. I stood on the Golan Heights last year. They're not going anywhere. There's no way that Syria is ever going to retake the Golan Heights, I can assure you, nor should they ever, nor should we ever allow that to happen. This is more of a political issue, I think, and the timing and all the rest of that, again, is very interesting. And
you think it's a coincidence that Benjamin Netanyahu's up for re-election?
Do they do politics in Washington and in Tel Aviv?
Yeah.
And Jerusalem, of course.
Yeah.
I'm shocked.
Okay. Another hotspot is Russia. Of course, U.S. intelligence agents believe that Russia interfered in our last election.
And what? Tried to do the same in other countries' elections in more recent years.
So, assuming that they want to do that again, assuming that Russia wants to interfere in the 2020 election in America, what should the U.S. military be doing, and are we doing that?
We actually, it's now publicly known that we have been taking action, and that in and around the midterm, when various interference was detected, that we in fact made sure they knew that we knew that they were doing that, and then actually carried out some denial of service attacks to disrupt what it is that they were trying to do. Now, there's a little bit of a discussion about this always in the intelligence world, because if you actually allow the other side to know what you know, you can actually you can put sources and methods in jeopardy. So you have to be careful about that. But I think this is so far down the road that there's no question that we should continue to do that. This is why we built what is now called Cyber Command, why it's now been elevated by this administration to fully fledged combatant command status, something I felt that should have been done years earlier. It's why we built all these elements with cyber warriors and so forth. And we're going to have to do more and more of that. And likely, as always, you always want not just a single effort, you want a comprehensive approach. And so certainly there should be more sanctions if this continues, there should be more lawsuits if it continues, there should be more diplomatic initiatives in addition to what it is that we're going to do in cyberspace to make it very difficult for them to do that, and then also to ensure that they realize that, that we know that they are doing that. Beyond that, we obviously have to get more support from social media providers and from internet service providers. They have to do a better job this next time than was done, obviously, in the previous election, where there was no question but that Russia was intent on inflaming various debates, essentially literally the equivalent in social media of pouring gasoline on burning embers to try to magnify the differences in a country that already was experiencing a degree of partisanship. And then also they did, at the end of the day, try to put a finger on the scales of the election. No one will ever know if that truly made a determinative difference. But given that the election was determined by about 80,000 or so votes in three states, you know, who can know? And there are actually some serious academics, including a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, who have actually established that case, at least reasonably plausibly. So again, that was
Hillary Clinton is
a
believer in that case.
I would assume that she is a believer in that case. Yeah. Lots of other factors, though.
Right.
And of course, again, nothing that could ever be truly proven, I don't think. So again, that's what we've got to do. We have to push back. We have to show that this is absolutely unacceptable. And by the way, it shouldn't just be the U.S. government and the social media and internet service providers. It should be all our allies and partners together. And this is why allies and partners matter in these kinds of endeavors.
One last hotspot question, then I'm going to ask a generic sort of big leadership question. North Korea, the other big hotspot that a lot of people are focused on. You've been in a situation where you've had to deal with complicated leaders. And I don't think you've ever met Kim Jong-un.
No, but in fact, he assumed, he took over from his father toward the end of my time in the CIA.
But and how of course, do you, just in a general thing, when you have a leader that may not be totally trustworthy, how do you go about that as a policymaker? How do you sit in a meeting with somebody
like that? Wasn't it the former governor of this great state when he was president who said trust but verify?
Yeah.
And so that's what you have to do. You have to have a verification regime. You're going to, I mean, again, what we need to do with North Korea now, I don't think you can fault the president for trying something very unconventional, given what the conventional approach produced in the past, which wasn't, all that positive over the number of years, despite three presidents having different agreements with Kim Jong-un's predecessor. And so we gave it a shot to try to get complete, verifiable, and irreversible dismantlement of the nuclear and missile programs. We sought that before we would do the sanctions relief. I think the intelligence community was right when they said it was highly unlikely that Kim Jong-un would give up his nuclear arsenal, and certainly in that kind of arrangement, I think even more so. So now let's back up, and now let's pursue the kind of step-by-step approach that perhaps could take us forward from here, noting that Kim Jong-un was not in a position before to embark on that trail. I think he might be more inclined to do that now, but we're going to have to give something as we go along. And this would include, for example, a declaration of where all the missile and nuclear sites are, then a verification of those on the ground, an inventory, as they say. Keep in mind, we haven't been on the ground since I think it's about 2010 or so. It was before I was the CIA director, and I remember we actually looked back at that at the time, and we have not been on the ground. So it's nearly a decade since we've actually been there and actually seen all of the different facilities. And then start charting out, okay, and let's start with this. You said you were willing to do something about Yongbyon. Okay, then what would we do in return and move that along? Look, it is positive that there have not been additional missile or nuclear tests, as the president has noted rightly, since his meeting with Kim Jong-un in Singapore. I think it's generally good that the rhetoric has been dialed back. Of course, some of that rhetoric was to get the attention not just of Kim Jong-un, but of President Xi in China, that if something wasn't done to clamp down on the umbilical cord, through which over 90% of the trade travels to and from North Korea through China, that there could be some catastrophic event, which should worry everyone. So again, in the meantime, let's get the sanctions back more in force and clamp down on some of the sanctions evasion that's taken place with shifting of oil from one ship to another and a variety of other workarounds that they've discovered that allow them to avoid the sanctions.
Let's talk just, everybody here is going to be voting for president in a year. We have a primary in California, and then we have the general election next November. You have the unique insight as somebody who has sat in the Situation Room with multiple commanders in chief. What characteristics, because I don't think you're going to endorse anybody tonight, but what characteristics should voters be looking for when picking a future commander in chief? What do you look for?
Well, I mean, I think people might expect that you would say, well, you want a leader who's decisive and got integrity and has all these traditional sort of leadership qualities that we always look for, disciplined and works hard, and et cetera, et cetera. I think certainly you want those features in a president without question, but I think you want more than that. And I think the real question is, who is the candidate who can perform the duties of a strategic leader? And I've always defined these as four in number. And the first is the most important. It's to get the big ideas right. Then it's to communicate them through the breadth and depth of the organization and the population and the world. Third is to oversee their implementation. But this is where you carry out a lot of what might normally be seen as leadership, energy, example, your rhythm, your activities, the metrics, all the other stuff. And then there's a very important fourth task that is sometimes overlooked, where you really need to force yourself to sit down. I did it on a formal basis, 1 hour a month as the commander in Iraq and Afghanistan, and with a team that is actually collecting lessons on the battlefield or wherever it might be, you sit down and determine how you need to refine the big ideas and do it again and again and again. This is really crucial, and you've got to get the big ideas right. My experience is that that's something that is done iteratively, inclusively. You can't sit under the right tree and get hit on the head by Newton's apple fully formed, but you need somebody that can do that. And by the way, when you look at the surge in Iraq, as I mentioned earlier, the surge that mattered most was the surge of ideas. Keep in mind that adding 25,000 troops to an existing 140,000 wouldn't predict that you'd drive violence down by 85 or 90%. We were able to do that because we reversed virtually everything we were doing. Instead of consolidating on big bases, we went and lived with the people, which is the only way to secure people. 77 additional locations in Baghdad alone. We realized that you couldn't kill or capture your way out of industrial strength insurgency. You needed to reconcile with as many of the rank and file as you could, starting with the Sunni Arabs, probably 80,000 over time, and then another 23,000 or so of former Shia militia members. We realized that you had to rehabilitate people before you release them from a detainee facility. This sounds trivial. We had 27,000 detainees, and it was being called a terrorist training camp because there were extremists in the midst who were basically radicalizing even more those who came in the door and then went out the other side. So again, you've got to get the big ideas. This is the policies, and what we should obviously be really searching for, given our own convictions, needless to say, is who's the candidate who seems to have these big ideas right. And by the way, they need to be ideas that are realistic. Again, it's wonderful to have great objectives out there that, you know, even stretch objectives and all the rest of that. But gosh, you do have to have, you need to run that into reality before you put that out as what it is that you truly are going to pursue. And I think, again, that's the real question. Who's the candidate can do that? Also has these other qualities that certainly are required when it comes to overseeing the implementation of the big ideas.
And if you found that person and they asked you to be Secretary of State or Secretary of Defense, would you serve in the government again?
You never say never. And, you know, the greatest privilege in life, I think, is to serve a mission larger than the self, which generally has to do with your country. But, I mean, that's a long way off and a big, big hypothetical.
Our thanks to General Petraeus for that time. What a fascinating conversation about so many different hotspots. We hope you will subscribe to this podcast. We hope you'll listen to the podcast of the TV version of the show from this week and watch us on TV at 10:30 p.m. on Fox 11 in Los Angeles and at 6:30 a.m. in San Francisco on KTVU on Saturday mornings. Thank you so much. I'm Alex Michelson. Have a good one.